Hello, and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today, I'll be talking with Dakila Chungyalpa, director of the LOCA Initiative, and she'll be speaking about a guided meditation with focus on climate and eco-anxiety. Dakila Chungyalpa, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me about this topic.
Thank you so much for having me, Buzz. Yeah. This is great. I'm so excited to be here.
Terrific. There's a lot to talk about here. Guided meditation with a focus on climate and eco-anxiety. So we're talking about a very inner, personal way of dealing with a huge global crisis, and I'm really anxious to find out about how that works. But let's start out by just talking about your background. What led you up this path?
Mm-hmm. So my background is field conservation. Okay. I worked for the World Wildlife Fund for 14 years. And I come from the Himalayas, was very much raised in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. But I often joke about how when I came to the West to study, I quickly realized that I had to create a bifurcation of identity where I could be a scientist by day, but I couldn't be a Buddhist. So I became a scientist by day and a Buddhist by night, right?
Oh,
that
wow.
These were two things that were not accepted in the professional field. And this bifurcation of identity, I think, actually has ended up harming a lot of us, people of faith, of course, but also, generally speaking, people who really do have a spiritual connection to nature or to community or, within ourselves, let's say. And in my case, what happened was I was good at what I did. I was rewarded for what I did. I ended up becoming the WWF U.S. director for the Greater Mekong region and went out and began living in the Mekong region in Laos, some of the loveliest periods of my life. But also what I started experiencing really quickly was anxiety, which I'd never come across before. And in my case, it would show up as recurring nightmares where the forests have burned down and I'm the only living thing in the forest. And so there can be nothing scarier for an ecologist than that experience. And I just kept having this dream again and again. And I'm very privileged to have Tibetan Buddhist teachers and to be part of the lineage. And so in my case, I was able to request His Holiness the Karmapa for guidance. And he ended up amending a very well-known practice called Tonglen, which is giving and receiving. So it's sort of you can give your concerns and receive compassion, or you can receive somebody else's pain and offer your compassion, right?
Okay.
And so he amended this practice to address eco-anxiety and climate distress, which at that time, these terms didn't exist. We're talking about the early 2000s.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you
Yeah, so okay. None of these words existed. And over time, what I was realizing was that I was not the only one. Pretty much every one of my peers was describing some kind of trauma response, right, to what we were dealing with and working on. I think partly because the language of conservation is so couched in warlike language. And of course, if you do that, we're losing. If you create a binary of violence, then of course we're on the losing side. And so there is this constant trauma that keeps recurring among environmentalists. But I think for a lot of people who have their identity tied to land and water, there is also trauma happening that nobody at that time understood, which is, and in the beginning, I used to think I'm from the Bhutia community in the Himalayas. We as, we're a scheduled tribe and we have very strong connection to the land and waters. The land is alive for us. Let me put it that way. In the beginning, I thought, oh, this is happening only to indigenous peoples. And then over time, as I was sort of starting to ask peers, ask friends, ask everybody, and, scientists by training, so before you know it, you're doing a survey. What I started seeing is it's actually anybody who's tied to land. So farmers, right? Hunters, fishermen. I mean, you name it, people whose identity is tied to nature in some way. We're experiencing trauma because nature is collapsing and we all see it as some form or the other, right? And in one of the things that happened that really changed my direction was there was a paper by an Australian philosopher named Glenn Albrecht, and he coined a term. This was, I think, the first time he published was 2009, from what I remember. He coined a term called solastalgia, and that meant grieving for the earth, right? Grieving and having the sense of loss.
Say the word again.
Solastalgia.
Solastalgia.
And for me, it was as if a light bulb went off. Yeah. I just kind of, you know, changed my whole trajectory. I began working with faith leaders. I began working with indigenous leaders. I kind of really wanted to have this conversation in the environmental field at large about what we were experiencing internally doing the work. Mm-hmm. And how it seemed to me that somehow we had made things worse by taking the sacred out of the science. Because for the last two decades at that point, we'd sort of entered this very, neoliberal way of looking at environmental protection, which was as long as we can make an economic argument, we can convince governments and corporations and people. Mm. And the reality is that rarely motivates people to do something about the environment, right? Mm. It's often the emotional and spiritual connection that make us act. And before you knew it, I'd launched this program at WWF called Sacred Earth, and I began working with religious leaders all over the world in the Amazon, in East Africa, and other places. And then I really wanted to understand better what was happening to us psychologically, what was happening to the environmental field, but also how we were communicating, and in many cases, miscommunicating the environmental and climate crisis, right? That we were actually engendering hopelessness versus courage, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So you're working with faith communities, spiritual communities of all kinds.
Yes.
And I want to get into that later. And the goal is to learn how to deal with environmental crises in terms of your own anxiety. And is there also a component of action in order to prevent these things? How does the actual wheel meet the road here?
I love that. I love that phrase. So in 2009, I launched the LOCA initiative at UW-Madison. We're a cross-campus program, and we're housed at the Center for Healthy Minds, which is led by Dr. Richie Davidson, who's famous, right, for studying how meditation changes
We've
the brain.
We've done programs with him
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. So it's sort of been this wonderful meeting of similar minds, because we're both really invested in understanding, I think he would say, neuroplasticity. And I would say spiritual growth, you know, understanding how that happens and how that can sustain us for the long run. And so the way LOCA initiative is designed, we essentially have a vision of deep resilience, by which we mean inner community and planetary resilience are interdependent. You cannot achieve any one of these things alone. You have to work on all three.
Okay.
And one of the big problems in our modern day societies, we think of these three things as completely separate things, right? Environmental issues, social issues, psychological and emotional issues. Mm. And so with this as our vision, what I've done is basically create a course called The Psychology of Deep Resilience that provides, we launched it last year, and it provided 15 contemplative practices as we go through environmental and climate issues and solutions.
Okay.
So this is where the rubber meets the road.
Okay.
The contemplative practices that we provide are from a range of wisdom traditions, but they also really promote pro-environmental behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a practice where you just create a safe space for yourself and feel really good and get up and feel like you're one inch closer to enlightenment. It's also encouraging you.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly where, exactly what I was curious about, is how much of it is self-care and how much of it is actually reaching out into the world and making these differences.
So, so the fourth course in the course program is connection and community, because what we essentially end up saying, and we delve a lot into systemic root causes of the environmental and climate crisis, and we really try to get our learners to understand that individually we may not be able to do very much, but collectively we can do a lot.
Mm.
And so on many levels, including psychologically, it's absolutely necessary we find community band together and go out and work together. So that is one of the programs that LOCA has. And what we did with that program was we embedded research. So we have a very simple survey. One part of the research is that we have something called Check Your Pulse. People can basically, before they start, so they take the module, right? They study whatever it is, globalization, whatever they might be reading at that moment or watching in the videos. And then before you start your contemplative practice, we ask you to tell us what you're experiencing and rate that. You do the contemplative practice, then we ask you to check your pulse again. So you do the same thing again. And it's preliminary because we've only done this for a year. We've just taken the course down to revamp it and put it back up in January. Mm-hmm. We had over 1,500 learners from over 70 countries. This course is on edX.
Wow.
And it's preliminary, but what some of the research is showing is that, first of all, yes, there is definitely what you called earlier, eco-anxiety, climate distress, all of the many emotions that surround that, because it shows up in different ways for different people, right? Some people experience real anger. Some people experience despair. Some people are motivated to act. Some people just sort of become completely, I think, turned off, right?
Yeah, kind of shut down.
And so people experience it differently. These terms are catch-alls for a really huge range of emotions, which is why we want to know what individuals are experiencing, right? And so we notice that, first of all, that the emotion, the intensity of emotion comes down with contemplative practice. But something else we picked up on that I'm just really excited about is that the nature-based practices are opening up different emotions. So by which I mean, we noticed that when we moved away from more traditional contemplative practices, in the West, like mindfulness, for example, you know, when we move away from that towards nature sit spots or nature-based practices or indigenous land-based healing practices, one word comes up that doesn't come up before that, and that is joy. People experience joy in nature. And one of the things we know is that nature connectedness has completely plummeted in the last couple of decades. Most people, there is a definite age, sort of age group that still identifies closely with nature or identity groups. But for the most part, across the globe, nature connectedness has dropped.
Okay. What is the strongest subsection then of people in terms of age, gender, anything? What are you finding?
Urban populations, right? Very strongly in the West or in highly developed nations or in highly developed urban populations in the global South.
Okay.
So we're definitely seeing this disconnect taking place in these populations.
Okay.
I would say, you know, one of the things I often get asked doing work with Indigenous leaders is how do Indigenous leaders or Indigenous people still stay so resilient despite such histories of trauma? And they themselves have often talked about the fact that nature is alive to them and they belong to it. The sense that as a species, they are part of it. They don't see themselves as separate or dominant or in any of those dichotomies, right? They just see themselves as part of this larger identity. And so that protects them psychologically in a very deep, meaningful way. And I think that's something we can all learn from. And so I'm really excited to see what the research is bringing because I think it allows us to improve what we offer, obviously, in these courses and practices, but also B, really bring it back to the environmental and climate communities, you know, and kind of bring it back to some of the ABCs that we had moved away from, which is just engendering this awe, the sense of awe, the sense of connection with nature and with the earth, and allowing that to bloom into joy, really prioritizing joy as an emotion, which is so necessary when we think about being in a time of collapse, right?
Right, right. You've been at this about a year, you said.
The course has been up for a year. We took it down and are doing the research right now.
And the goal is to get to the emotion of joy. And so I imagine that you're finding how certain paths toward joy are working better, are more direct paths than others. Is that correct? And what are you finding in terms of how to bring people to that space?
I think something I did not expect, although in retrospect it seems kind of obvious, but something that showed up that we're still, it's preliminary, so I say all this with a caveat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what we noticed is because the courses are very systems-oriented and systems-based, we noticed that when we start talking about environmental and climate issues, the moment we move into systems analysis of these problems, the root causes, which is this is bigger than us individually. Mm-hmm. This is an entire neoliberal economic system that's taken over the world in 50 years. Right. You know, what is fascinating is even before people do the contemplative practice, they start talking about hope. And so there is something about taking a systems approach that make people feel more hopeful. Because you said this earlier, people are sort of, you know, climate change is just so enormous, right?
Yeah, it's almost unfathomable. It's something that we can't, it's like telling somebody that a program costs $10 trillion. You know, it's just, that's too big. We can't really grasp that.
Right. Yeah. And so, and it, I think a lot of the time when we talk about issues like that, it actually makes us feel smaller and weaker. Mm-hmm. So providing a way of thinking about it as a system and therefore thinking of it as part of a system that was set up, right, that mm-hmm. we ourselves may be contributing to very involuntarily, really,
yeah.
right? But that there is a way to address it that meets that scale.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that actually makes people feel empowered. And so I'm still sitting with it. We haven't done anything with this data. We're waiting.
Okay.
We need it to be, it has to be a certain size before we say, okay, yeah, now this feels real. Mm-hmm. But I think it's making me think a little bit about also why I began working with religions, right? Mm-hmm. I experienced myself a sense of real loss of faith in the environmental movement and in governments and mm-hmm. the private sector to fix the environmental problem.
Okay.
But I still knew individually, me as myself, couldn't do very much. And so I pivoted without, very intuitively, very organically, none of this was planned, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fell into thinking about other systems of power on the planet. And lo and behold, 80% of the human population subscribes to a religion, right?
Okay.
And it sort of was this light bulb moment for me that I could work with other institutions, you know, to address the same problems.
Yeah. But religions are so disparate in their their approach, their belief system. In fact, it often leads to conflict. How does the religious community or the spiritual community, which is such a huge umbrella, how do those people interact in your experience within your LOCA program? You've got Buddhists and you've got evangelicals.
Yes.
I can't imagine that there's a lot of common ground there.
So the way I approach working with faith leaders is really, you know, any community-based project manager would know exactly what I'm doing, which is really focusing from the ground up on that community. So every one of the projects we have where we have partnerships with faith leaders, the faith leaders are involved from the very beginning. They are actually co-creators of the project, and the project only focuses on that faith community. So the work example, with evangelicals.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all.
It's the opposite. Everything we do is the opposite of that.
Okay, very okay.
And we really lean into sort of, you know, positive communal emotions, pride and, you know, sense of belonging and ownership and all of those emotions, right? So the work I do with evangelicals started with a very long dialogue with Reverend Ed Brown, who is a well-known creation care leader here in Madison. He's in his 70s. He's evangelical, white, has a beard, you know, is just sort of very outgoing, very personable. And he and I take we are the two sides of this project, basically.
All right, two
and
sides of the coin.
He interfaces with evangelical church leaders, and I work with the university, and we bring all the university scientists, and he brings the pastors, and we basically have this closed-door 5-day event every year where we bring a new cohort of pastors in and church leaders in and our scientists, and they are in dialogue and helping them think through all kinds of things, including often climate denialism, right? It's not like the pastors come in believing in climate change always.
That was my next question, is I have this vision of the evangelical community as being largely politically conservative, and part of that movement is a denial of climate change and what's happening. So that's got to be a big hurdle. I mean, you know, for one thing, the irony here is that they wouldn't be experiencing eco-anxiety, some of them, because they don't believe it's happening. Is that correct?
That's so interesting. I don't think that's correct.
Okay, I do think great. I want to be wrong on this. Okay,
so something I'm really aware of, mainly paying attention to historians, is how, you know, when we go through any kind of natural scarcity or we go through disasters, people actually start experiencing the same emotions, even though they might not attribute it to the same cause, right?
Okay.
And so people are experiencing this heightened sense of anxiety, heightened sense of helplessness, rage, right? Feeling vulnerable, and in some cases, of course, feeling victimized or feeling harmed directly and so on, right? Feeling overlooked. And so that can propel you towards some extreme behavior, or that can propel you to build community, right?
Okay.
And so for Loka, obviously, we are really trying to in many ways build these bridges with different faith leaders, because they can influence communities in a way no scientist can, no government can, right? And to normalize the idea that, so in evangelical speak or Christian speak, it would be creation, to normalize the idea that creation requires protection. And if we protect creation, we're doing God's will, right? It's a gospel issue. And we're also protecting our community.
Okay.
So my way of working with faith communities where there is resistance is to actually never use words that trigger them, but to describe the phenomenon, right? In words that make sense to them. And then it really is to lean into what we do have in common versus focusing on what we don't have in common, you know? And so it's sort of just respecting another individual to say, we might not agree on these things, but here is what we do agree on. So let's, you know, this happens in marriage, right? Often. Do you have a healthy marriage? At some point you go, okay, we're never going to agree on this.
Right.
And it's sort of...
I'm divorced, so I claim no degree of expertise on this topic at all.
Or like positive family relationships. So old friends, right? Yeah. We do this all the time at an individual level. And I think we're just applying that and applying this... the respect, the way the respect has to show up when you do community-based work is you really invest in trust building. You don't bypass it.
Okay.
And I think a lot of times in the Western world, in the Western sort of, you know, we go professional world, right? We're often taught how to bypass it. You know, like we give a card with our labels on it, right? We tell people we have a master's or a PhD, and it's our way of shortcutting the process. What we're really saying is, trust me because I'm an expert.
Yes.
Or trust.
Right.
And the truth is, doing this kind of community-based work with faith leaders and indigenous leaders, there is no bypassing that, the process of just showing up year after year after year.
Yeah.
And just letting them get to know you and start to trust you, even though, you know, in my case, I often joke, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist tribal Himalayan woman that is working with mostly white evangelical pastors, you know?
Right.
But it's sort of, there's a lot of humor in it. And there is a running joke that I'm their favorite Buddhist because I'm the only Buddhist they know.
Right. Well, there you go. It puts you right at the top of the list.
Yeah.
How does someone... let's say someone's listening to this podcast right now and they say, I'm experiencing this kind of anxiety. I would really love to get in touch with Dakila, and I would love to be able to get in touch with the Loka program. Can individuals do that, or do they have to do it through a church or through a spiritual leader? How does someone get involved?
We, so of course people can reach out to us, you know, we're a small team of ants, mighty and small.
Okay.
The main motivation for creating the Psychology of Deep Resilience course was because I actually couldn't keep up with the amount of requests I was getting. Because His Holiness gave me this practice, and this practice actually healed me, the Tonglen practice I mentioned, I really wanted to make more contemplative practices available to people who are experiencing eco-anxiety and climate distress. And really with the acceptance that things are collapsing. Because I think part of the suffering that we experience is the dissonance, because we are so uncomfortable to talk about collapsing. Well, in the West, we're uncomfortable to talk about anything related to death and dying, right? So this idea of just saying, hey, you know what? Yes, things are in flux. Things are collapsing. There are things that will disappear is going to be extremely hard for us. There are societies that are falling apart. There are islands that are going underwater, right? That is the reality. So we build our contemplative practices with an acceptance of that, which I think brings a kind of cognitive and emotional recalibration, you know, which is, okay, we're going to start with the grief and we're going to move to gratitude. And from there, we're going to move to courage. And from courage, we're going to move to action.
So the Does Loka Initiative, I imagine you have a website.
Yes, it's lokainitiative.org.
Okay, that's L-O-K-A, for those of you listening, initiative.org. Wow, there are other things I'm curious about. Maybe we'll have to have you back, but at this point, we should probably wrap it up. But I do want to ask you one more thing. When you're not doing all this kind of stuff, what are your personal interests? Do you have hobbies or sports? Or
I do.
You're from the Himalayas, so I imagine you climb mountains.
I do spend as much time as I can in wilderness up north.
Yeah,
and so I take every chance I can get to go be with some of our native partners. I've had some really wonderful experiences up on the Menominee Reservation, for example. And I spend a lot of time gardening. I've been trying to rewild my lawn.
Nice.
And nobody told me that you start with a patch and you think you're going to keep moving the patch. And actually, all you do is work on the same patch every year.
The same patch, right. Yeah,
It's a lot of work.
I bet.
But I've been trying to rewild my lawn. And I, my husband and I, we explore a lot. We both love kayaking. So we do that
terrific.
A lot in the summer.
Terrific.
It's quite lovely.
Yeah. Dakila, let's end the interview with a brief contemplative practice, if you would.
Oh, I would love to offer this. Let me offer a very abbreviated version of the Tonglen practice I've been naming all this time. The Tonglen practice that was given to me is by His Holiness, the 17 Karmapa, and it's very much amended from the traditional practice that comes as part of Lojong. But I think for people who are aware of Tibetan Buddhism, this will be familiar. And for those of you who aren't, this is just think of it as a nature-based practice. So the first thing I want everyone to do is just settle in and get comfortable wherever they are, standing, sitting, cross-legged. And just straighten up your body. Imagine that there is a string that's pulling you up from the top of your head. And so align yourself and then let the string go and just settle in. We are going to start by just acknowledging that our body is our primary home. Our bodies do everything we ask it to. Run around, lift things, embrace people, type things up, right? It's constantly working to meet our aspirations and goals. And so let's start with just naming how hard our bodies work, what they carry, and allowing gratitude to infuse every part of our body right now with every breath. As you take your breath in, allow the breath to fill up your belly first. And then when you exhale, allow the breath to leave your belly. So you're infusing, in a sense, gratitude through your bloodstream as you breathe in and breathe out. Now, with this sense of gratitude, I invite you to bring your awareness to the breath itself. And just imagine that cocktail of oxygen and carbon and nitrogen that is entering your nostrils or your mouth, right? And where it comes from. It's coming from phytoplankton in the oceans, far, far away. The forests near us, the plants in our house, biomass everywhere, right? This oxygen that gives us life, that allows us to do all the things we love, comes effortlessly, unconditionally from the earth. We literally, with every breath, breathe in the earth's compassion. And so take a moment to name the emotion that comes as a response to that. When you imagine where the oxygen comes from, the way it comes to you, it arrives at you right as you need to take a breath. What arises for you? And so as you breathe out, that emotion is what you can express with your breath. It could be a simple thank you to the earth. It could be a deeper sense of interconnectedness and acknowledgement of interdependence with the earth. It could be compassion in return, right? Any emotion. And so we're going to do this a few times. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. At any point in the day, at any point in the week, when things get really stressful or you feel overwhelmed, just allow yourself to focus on your breath and remind yourself that you are connected with the earth no matter where you are, no matter what your circumstances are. The earth is giving you life moment to moment to moment. The earth wants you to live and flourish and turn your faces to the sun. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. Wow, terrific. Ah, I have no way to respond to that other than that. Yeah, that felt good. Thank you.
I hope it helps. I know we're all experiencing, I think, a certain amount of panic and confusion day to day right now, especially. You know, I often talk about systems work because I think that allows us to take a step back from the panic and to look for other people who think like us and who want to act in a way that is positive, right? So really, I think this is one of my deepest hopes with the LOCA initiative is what we're essentially doing is saying, you know, build up your reserves individually and then find community. And those two things go hand in hand.
Yes, that makes sense. And I am reminded of, speaking of Himalayas, I am reminded of a quote from Sir Edmund Hillary after he and Tenzing Norgay were the first to reach the summit of Mount Everest and then get back down safely. One of his famous quotes is, "It is not the mountain that we conquer, but ourselves."
Absolutely.
And so it all starts within us. Dakila Chungyalpa, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be here. It's lovely to meet you in person.
Yeah, you as well. You as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dakila Chungyalpa. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. The Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our engineer is Maggie Shays. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.